Good morning. It's difficult for us to understand and to connect with some of the events that we're going to read about this morning, which are in Acts chapter 21. Don't bother turning there yet. We'll get to it in a minute. But in order to comprehend at least some of the levels of the revelation of God that you find in some of these passages, you have to know a little bit about what was going on in Israel at the time. What it was like to be a Jewish believer. Because when Jesus Christ came into the Jewish community and spoke what he spoke and did what he did, it literally blew their minds. It shouldn't have, but it did. The message of Christ was absolutely revolutionary to Judaism, as the way Judaism was practiced in the first century. And nowhere is this more clearly seen than in the way Jesus related to the temple. The temple was the heart of Judaism. It was where all the sacrifices occurred. And more than that, it had also become the financial center of that part of Israel. Everybody in Jerusalem made their living, or almost everybody, made their living in some way or other related to the temple. Even if it wasn't direct, it was indirect. The temple was the heartbeat, economically and spiritually and theologically, of Israel. And very especially of Jerusalem. When Jesus came to the temple and cleansed it and said, you guys are doing this all wrong, you must understand this was no light thing. This was not taken as something that, well, just anybody might do this on an off day. This was a thrust at the very heart of what it meant to be Jewish at the time. And his message, which was a message of repentance and faith, through him rather than through the temple, and implicitly a rebuke of the temple, stands to this day as one of the most revolutionary messages ever spoken. I'd like you to turn with me to Mark chapter 11 and have a look at this, and you'll see how it fits into what we're going to talk about this morning in just a moment. But Mark 11, and just relive one of the events that transpired at the beginning of the last week of Jesus' life, the beginning of the last week. What we call Passion Week, we usually celebrate Passion Week just before Easter in the springtime. And after the triumphal entry, after Christ entered the city of Jerusalem at the end of his ministry, and he was very well known, and it was quite a stir that he caused by coming to Jerusalem at Passover. The very next thing he did, essentially, was to go to the temple and to clean out the court of the Gentiles. Now, the temple was built in such a way that the main structure of the temple was relatively small. And then there was and no one could go in there except the high priest. And certain other priests could go into the outer portion of it. That was the only part with a roof, that small center in the middle, that small building in the middle. Then there was an open courtyard, which was the court of the priests, and only priests could go in there. And then on the outside of that was the courtyard of the Israelite men, and only males who were in good standing in the Israelite community could go into that courtyard. And then further out was the court of the women, where all Israelites could go, male and female, young and old, could go into the court of the women. And then there were some heavy gates that opened onto a further courtyard. Now, this was the largest, by far the largest of all of them, and this outside one was called the Court of the Gentiles. But the Jews did not treat the Court of the Gentiles as if it were important at all. In fact, by the time Jesus had come, the Jews had turned it into something of a marketplace to buy and sell the sacrificial animals. Most of you remember the story. And they were ripping the people off, and it was quite crooked, and it had become a situation in which it was existing strictly for the elite, strictly for the spiritual elite. That was the whole purpose that the temple had degenerated into. And when Jesus came on this day, in the beginning of the last week of his life, his earthly life here on earth, what he does is he does a symbolic cleansing. It didn't really cleanse the temple when he came in there. It was a symbolic thing. He was taking authority, and he was pointing out what was wrong with what was going on there. Now, I want you to look with me at verse 15 of Mark 11. And just read through this and get a feel for what's going on. They came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to cast out those who were buying and selling in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling the doves. Now, this is not in the temple proper. This is just outside the temple proper. The temple proper ended at the gate of the women. This is out in the in the courtyard where the Jews didn't think it was all that holy anyway. See, they didn't view this as any kind of a problem because they didn't see it as holy. They were very strict about what they saw as holy. But this outside thing was about the Gentiles, and they didn't care about the Gentiles. And that is part of the problem, the court of the Gentiles. Verse 16, and he would not permit anyone to carry goods through the temple. That meant the temple, the court of the Gentiles again, because there's a shortcut that you can take from the old city of Jerusalem through. You can't now, but in those days, you could take a shortcut through the temple area, the court of the Gentiles, and go out the eastern gate and go straight out to the valley of the Kidron and across to Bethany and so on. And it was easier than going all the way around. And it was only the Gentiles, after all. It was just their court, and who cared about the Gentiles? So it was business, just a up and down and back and forth, and buying and selling the stuff, and making money off the people, and simply serving the religious elite. And he stopped that. He stopped the whole thing. Verse 17, and then he began to teach. And by the way, Jesus always taught in the court of the Gentiles. He always taught out there, where just any old buddy could come and listen. Very interesting. And he had every right to go all the way in. Never forget that. He had every right to go in even when it wasn't the Day of Atonement. He could go all the way to the Holy of Holies if he wanted to. So he stayed in the court of the Gentiles. He kicked out all of the crooks, and he stayed out there and he taught. And this is part of what he said. This is only just a tiny little synopsis of what he said on that day. But he said, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? But you have made it into a robber's den. This is Isaiah 56:7. You've made a house of prayer for all the nations. I want you to underline the word nations there. It's the word for the Greek word used here, ethne, means the non-Jewish nations. All the peoples is the way it's rendered from Hebrew back in Isaiah. But the emphasis here is that this is supposed to be a place where people can come and hear about who I am. Now, it's true that it's okay that they can't go all the way in. That's the way the old covenant worked. But that doesn't mean you're supposed to trash the outside and make it as if these people don't matter. Because actually, God is interested in the salvation of all human beings. And so, when the Lord comes and he cleanses us, he quotes Isaiah. And by doing this, he takes a huge amount of authority, shocks the people. This is at the heart of Judaism, and they thought they had it all wired. They thought they had it all organized. They were in charge of God's revelation. And Jesus comes along, and he takes that revelation away. And he says, no, this is my message, and I'm telling you, you are doing it wrong. It's just an amazing thing. Robbers, they come and take what they want and then go hide and keep it. That's exactly what the priests were doing. Taking what they wanted from the people as if it was all meant for them, and then just keeping it. And God said, no, your purpose was to bring it out to other people. You guys are crooks. Now, from that verse 18, and the chief priests and the scribes heard this, they began seeking how to destroy him, for they were afraid of him, for all the multitude was astonished at his teaching. This cleansing of the temple began the course of events, which ended in his crucifixion at the end of this week. See, 5 days later, these people were crying out, away with this man, away with this man, right? By the end of the week. Why? Because he presumed to say, no, this is the wrong message you're giving here. And furthermore, he demonstrated in everything he said and everything he did that it wasn't about the temple anymore. Now, you tell people that it's not about the center of their livelihood and the center of their religious tradition and the center of their cultural tradition for the last as far back as any of them could remember and think. You tell them, that's all done. You got to put your weight full down on me now. Boy, I tell you, that's the way to make enemies. And he made serious enemies. They hated him for this. The people, the grassroots people, at first thought he was going to deliver him from the Romans. When they found out that wasn't going to happen, at least not then, they turned on him at the end of the week. It's away with this man. I want you to bear that in mind. You say, well, what in the world does this have to do with understanding Acts chapter 21? Oh, it has everything in the world to do with it. Turn with me to Acts 21, because some 27 to 28 years after the events you just read about, history repeats itself. The Apostle Paul is on his way to Jerusalem. It's at the end of the third missionary journey. Let me bring you up to speed. This last missionary journey has taken several years. He has been up in Asia preaching the gospel to Gentiles, and thousands have been coming to Christ. They've been coming to the Lord, they've been excited about it. And all through this period of time, Paul always had it in his mind, I'm going to get back to Jerusalem. I'm going to take back to Jerusalem a gift from these Gentile churches. Because Jerusalem, at the time, was in a famine. And the church back at Jerusalem was hurting. All the Jewish Christians back in Jerusalem were hurting. And so Paul has been out ministering to the Gentiles. Now remember that there's still a huge rift between the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians. A huge rift between them. And Paul is determined to the best of his ability to try and heal that. So he's taken a financial gift. Everywhere he went on this third journey, he took an offering. Not for himself, but he took an offering to take back. And also wherever he went, he gathered men from the different Gentile churches. Berea, Thessalonica, Philippi, Ephesus, Troas, Corinth. All of them up around the Aegean and on the way back. And these guys came with him, not just as bodyguards, but to take this collection back to Jerusalem. He's intent on this. Because he wants more than anything for the people back home to realize there doesn't need to be a rift between the Jewish and the Gentile believers. In fact, I want you to see just how emotional he was about it and what was really on his heart. Remember I told you that he had written Romans just before this? It's very much in his mind. If you want to know what was in his heart during this period of time, read the book of Romans. And I'd like you to turn with me to Romans 15. At the end of the book, he reveals what's going on because he wrote this just before he left from Corinth to go back to Jerusalem. Romans 15. He explains about the gift in verses 26 to 29. That these Christians had been giving so that the Jerusalem believers would be helped. Romans 15. And in verse 30, now look at what is in his heart. I want you to get into his head here for a minute and see what might have been happening in him to ask for this. He says, "Now I urge you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, to strive together with me in your prayers to God for me." It's a strong word, strive together, to agonize together with me by being a prayer partner, by being involved in it. Would you please do that, he says to these Romans, who hasn't even met them, but they're in Rome, and he eventually wants to get there. He sends this letter off. He says, please pray for me. Verse 31, here's what to pray for. Two things, that I may be delivered from those who are disobedient in Judea, and that my service for Jerusalem may prove acceptable to the saints. Now we read through that, you guys, like we do so many times in the scriptures. We blow right past it, and we don't ask ourselves what's going on in his mind that he should ask these things. Well, first of all, who are the disobedient he needs deliverance from? Got to be the Jewish people who haven't come to Christ. That's who that is. And he's very concerned because all the way along, what has the Spirit been telling him everywhere he goes on this trip so far? He's going to get in trouble. He's going to be beaten up. He's going to be chained. He's going to be strapped down. He's going to have all this trouble everywhere along. We've seen that in the Agabus prophecy last week. We looked at it. So he knows he's walking right into some very serious danger here. And he's pretty sure that the danger is probably going to come from the Jewish people, but he's still going to go straight to it. They're his people. He knows everything about them. He knows more about them than they know about themselves. And he is not afraid to go there. So he's praying for deliverance from these people. And then, oh, by the way, if you know the story, it does make you wonder what God means by deliverance, doesn't it? You know what happens to Paul when he gets to Jerusalem? We're going to read about it in the next few weeks. You know, when we say deliver me from, we mean don't let even a raindrop hit me on the head. We mean don't let anything in the least bit, discomforting ever happen in my life. That's what I mean by deliver me. That's what I've got written. I say deliver me, I mean I want to have a good time. Deliver me and don't let anyone. And God reads, deliver you, he means you will live. Very different. But he says he wants to be delivered. He knows he's going to be beat up. He's not praying that he won't be beat up. He knows that's going to happen. He's praying that he'll live. Very interesting. He's also praying that his service will be acceptable to the saints. Now we think to ourselves, well, why should he even bother praying? That's like a given, isn't it? No, it's not. Remember, he's been out there with the Gentiles, and this huge rift between the Jewish and the Gentile church is the biggest problem in the first century. It always has been. It always has been. The whole first century is racked with this difficulty because the Jewish Christians had a hard time believing you could get saved and not act Jewish. And here they were still worshiping at the temple, which was okay for them. We'll talk about it in a minute. But he wants to make, he's praying, and it's a serious prayer because he's not sure it will happen. When he gets there, he knows he's a hot potato. He knows that he is a controversial person. And he's going to get there and he's going to hope that somehow he's going to have a good time with these folks and a good reception with them. Do you ever have to go someplace or do something where you're not sure at all that you're going to have any kind of warm reception? But you know, still, it's the right thing for you to do. So you just pray, Lord, whatever happens, I hope it turns out okay. Well, that's exactly the way he feels. He is not certain. And he's taking 10 Gentile Christians with him into Jerusalem. And him, Paul, known throughout the empire among the Jewish community as a traitor to Judaism, as a friend of the Gentiles and the tax gatherers and the sinners, just like his own Lord, and as a person who didn't care about the law, and we're going to see exactly this, how that happens here. So here's Paul on his way to Jerusalem in this state. Let's go back now to Acts chapter 21. A couple of other things that you need to be aware of. Well, one in particular. He's entering into a politically volatile climate. This doesn't come out in this text, and so people read it through and it's too simple. It was actually far more complex than it appears on paper. And isn't your life that way? Do you ever write a resume for yourself? Do you ever have to write a resume? Doesn't your life look pretty good on a resume generally? Or at least simple? And then you think to yourself, well, you know, but if I were to really tell the whole story about how that happened, it would be like this big, long, huge novel, right? Everything looks simple on paper. It was far more complex in reality here. And one of the complexities you need to know about is the political situation in Jerusalem in 57 A.D. The political situation in Jerusalem in 57 A.D. was absolutely terrible. There were terrorists on every side. They were Jewish terrorists who were fighting the Romans. They were called the Sicarii. And they were the dagger people. That was what they were called. The dagger men. And that was because they had daggers, they had knives, and they would kill a Roman on the street and take off before anybody could catch them. They hated the Romans. There was insurrection in the air all the time among the Jews. This was the beginning of a war which would eventually end 12 years later with the destruction of Jerusalem and the complete leveling of Jerusalem and the crucifixion of all the male survivors of Jerusalem in that battle, or almost all of them. The Romans were going to come within 12 years and destroy this city completely. And the main reason is because of the political agitation that the Jews were bringing about. And it was starting now as Paul goes back into this. So he's walking into a very complex, politically very agitated, very dangerous thing at a time when people might be thinking it would be good not to go to Jerusalem. Kind of like now, you know. Be good. People are saying, I'm going to cancel my trip to Israel. Why? Well, it's just too much of a, it's too agitated. Too violent. That's exactly the way it was. And Paul does this. He goes there. That's going to play very heavily because I want you to remember what he does is he takes with him Gentiles. How popular do you think Gentiles, especially Roman Gentiles, are in the city of Jerusalem during this political situation? Not popular at all. How popular do you think a perceived traitor, ex-Pharisee, PhD, who's out there talking about the Messiah coming back from the dead and is telling Gentiles they don't have to act Jewish and telling Jewish people they don't have to act Jewish. How popular do you think that guy's going to be? This is a very dangerous thing Paul's doing here. That's why he prays. He asks the Romans, would you pray with me? It's very serious. We read the end into the beginning of everything and it dissipates it of all the trauma that we normally feel in life. So get a feel for what's going on. Now when he comes in, verse 17 of chapter 21 is where it begins. He arrives finally in Jerusalem. And it says, notice the answers to prayer in the first few verses. They received us gladly. We came to Jerusalem. The brethren received us gladly. Notice it says us. That means Luke is with him. And now the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Again, you guys, we read through this and we don't see it for what it is. James was the half-brother of Jesus. He's the author of the book of James. He was a very well-respected leader in the early church. He was very, very Jewish. And he taught the Christians, the Jewish Christians, that they could remain Jewish in every way, and that's exactly the way it should have been taught at that time among those people in Jerusalem. I'll explain more about that in just a moment. And James, there are no other apostles living in Jerusalem now. They've all spread out to the other parts of the world, exactly as Jesus said they would. And now there's a series of elders. These are mature, long-term Christians who have suffered for their faith. They are wise men who love the Lord and who are of Jewish extraction and who are very loyal to their traditions as Jews. These are the guys that Paul was afraid when he got there might not be too enthused about what was going on. And in walks Paul on this morning, Paul the Apostle, with his 10 Gentile buds, representatives of all these churches. And here's the leaders of the Jerusalem church looking as Jewish can be, and James among them. What a scene. What a moment. And in walks the brothers from Berea with a couple of bags of precious silver coins to buy food. Boom, puts them on the table. These are from the Christians in Berea. Boom, he walks away. And then the guy from Thessalonica walks in. Boom, boom, two more bags. These are from the brothers in Thessalonica. Boom, he walks away. Wow. And all these guys, one at a time, they bring the money in. Huge gift. Awesome moment. And then Paul began to tell them, do you know how many people are coming to Christ out there in the empire? It's amazing what God has done among the Gentiles. And they listened carefully. The Jewish guys listened as Paul related all that was going on. And it says they glorified God for it, for what was happening. Verse 19. After he had greeted them, began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they began glorifying God. What a difference that is from when they first heard many years ago, when Peter first preached to Cornelius, the first Gentile, remember, that got connected with Jesus, and how difficult it was for the people to accept it. That, my goodness, God is saving Gentiles. And that was even 10 years after Pentecost. It was hard for them then, but now things have changed. Remember back when Paul went up to Antioch, or Barnabas went up to Antioch and the Gentile church up there, that first big Gentile outreach north of Israel, and he called Paul to come down from Tarsus and be the AP before any of the missionary journeys or anything. Remember how that caused a ruckus down in Jerusalem, and everybody had to come down and have the big meeting in chapter 15, the Jerusalem Council. And there was this awesome thing that finally the brothers said, Paul's right. We agree. The Lord wants to save Gentiles. We don't have to make everybody act Jewish. Major, major decision. Big, big decision was going on. Now look at this. Things have really, it is a good thing. These folks are now rejoicing that Gentiles are being saved throughout the empire. This is really good. However, they have a political problem. They're between a rock and a hard place because Paul has such a bad reputation among the Jewish people and among a lot of the Jewish Christians, because the rumors have been circulating about how bad he is and how he's telling everybody you don't have to be Jewish. And even though they technically knew this was true, this was not on the cover of their Christian flyer that they would put out, you know, down at the synagogue. They didn't want to make this, you know, they kind of let this kind of go by. And if they were asked, do Gentiles have to act like Jews? They would have to say, well, no, technically no. But it didn't matter to them because they were all Jewish anyway, so they just kept the traditions and it wasn't a big deal. Well, now with Paul getting back there, it put him in a very hard place. So James and the elders say, look, brother, you see how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. Thousands of converts of Jewish people in Jerusalem. And they are zealous for the law. Zealous for the law? I mean, now, okay, we've been on the mission field, you and me. We've been out there watching Paul do everything among the Gentiles, and we're just, and besides, most of us are Gentiles, so we just think this is the, of course, this is the way it should be. We come back here and we think, Christians, zealous for the law? Come on. It's not about the law. It's not about the temple. And people read this and they think, how can this be? Are these real Christians? Well, yes, they are. Because, and you got to understand this, this was a transitional period. A transitional period where Jewish Christians worshipped at the temple. It only lasted for a few years, less than a generation, because the Lord took the temple out of there. It got destroyed in 70 AD. And from then on, Judaism declared Christianity a heresy, and there wasn't a question of whether you could be a Jewish person and hold the old traditions and be a Christian. That question just didn't come up after 70 AD. But in this interim period, it did. And it was okay. It was okay for them to be zealous for the law. These are transitional Jewish believers. Transitional Jewish believers. So it's okay. It's not okay anymore. This was only okay until 70 AD when the temple went away. Raise your hand if you understand what I just said. Okay? Does that make sense? Is that clicking a little bit as to why they did this? Don't let it bother you. They've been told, he said, about you, that you're teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles, you're teaching them to forsake Moses. Now, that wasn't true at all. What he was teaching them was that Jesus is the Messiah and you're saved by grace through faith in him rather than by obeying Moses. But he wasn't telling them that Moses was no good. He was not telling the Jews that they couldn't act Jewish. But that's what they've heard that you're doing. To forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, not to walk according to the customs. Serious accusations. What then is to be done, said James? They will certainly hear that you've come. Therefore, do this, that we may tell you. And we have four men who are under a vow. This is probably a Nazarite vow, Old Testament vow. He says, you take them, you purify yourself along with them. Join them in the last week of their vow. Pay their expenses in order that they may shave their heads. And all will know that there's nothing to the things about what has been told about you. But that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. And then he repeats what they got in chapter 15 concerning the Gentiles who believed, we wrote. And James is saying, you know, we're not going back on this. Concerning the Gentiles, all they need to do is not eat meat sacrificed by idols or to idols, not drink blood, not eat strangled stuff, and stay away from fornication. That was all that they had to do to make friends with their Jewish believers. It was a concession to the Jewish communities. But he says, we're not going back on that. But he says, I'd like you to act like a really good Jewish guy while you're here. Would you do that? That's basically what he's asking. And Paul did it. Verse 26. Paul took the men the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. They shaved their heads, not Paul, but the others. After you took a Nazarite vow, you were supposed to shave all your hair off and take it to the priest in a baggie, and he'd burn part of it and do a bunch of stuff, and it was all part of the fulfillment of the vow. So Paul went right into this. Can you imagine him walking into the temple area and being with these guys and doing the whole Jewish thing? Some people are so bothered when they look at this. They say, how in the world could Paul do such a thing? The man who told the Galatians, don't go back to the law. He was so angry about it. What's he doing? Well, we'll talk about it in just a minute. But I am convinced he was not doing anything wrong because he was in this transitional phase as a Jewish man. Now, if he'd have been Trophimus or if he'd have taken one of his Greek buddies in there and told them to act Jewish and come in and do these things, that would have been absolute hypocrisy. But because Paul was Jewish, it was okay for him to do it. And the Lord does not rebuke him for it. Well, he had a warm response from the Christians, but he has a very hot response from the Jews. Verse 27. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the multitude, and they laid hands on him, crying out, men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people. That's not true. And against the law. That's not true. And against this place. That wasn't true either. These were all suppositions. But this guy's yelling, and he's saying, this is him, this is Saul of Tarsus. And besides, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. Because they'd previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him. And they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. There was a wall between the court of the Gentiles and the court of the Israelite women. That said, if you go past this wall and you go into this other court, you have no one to blame but yourself for your ensuing death. That's what it said. In fact, there were several of these signs all the way along. They found a couple of them. Archaeological expeditions have found some of these. And so there's no question that a guy could get killed if he went in there. There's no record of anybody being killed. They would have killed Paul if he hadn't been rescued here. But that's why. He's brought a Greek in here. Now, that wasn't true either. He didn't bring Trophimus in. But you see how the crowd just got completely whipped up about it? Everybody's freaked out. So they grab Paul, and you can just see, you know, Paul's with his other brothers. Imagine what a scene that would be. You're there fulfilling your vow, saying, I'm doing what God has told me to do so I don't mess up my relationship with God in the temple here. And he gets accused of doing exactly that, messing up everything in the temple. Accused of being a criminal right there. His three or four buds that were the Jewish Christian guys that he was there with, what happened to them? We don't know. They probably said, whoa, look at the time. Got to get home. Who knows? But it's about Paul mostly. So they drug him out. They're beating on him. They're just thrashing him. And everybody's just in this insane mood. Verse 31. And they were seeking to kill him. And a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. Well, he heard what was going on. The Roman cohort was housed. The Roman guards were housed at the fortress of Antonia, which is located directly adjacent to the court of the Gentiles. Right on the north side, it shares a wall with the court of the Gentiles. From the parapet of the fortress of Antonia, you could look over into the court of the Gentiles. So they heard the ruckus, and the reason, by the way, that they did that was because if there was going to be a riot, it would almost always start out there. So that's why the Romans had their guards right there. So they heard this thing going on. And the commander hears this noise and this tumult, and he hears all this going on. They're going to kill a guy. So he gets a bunch of soldiers together, and there's a staircase that they can enter the court of the Gentiles from the fortress of Antonia. So they have their own entrance, the Romans do. So they come down the staircase, come pouring down in there, and going to find this, what's going on, and yada, yada. And he tries to figure out what's typical riot scene, tries to figure out what's going on, can't figure it out. So he sees Paul's at the middle of it, so he arrests him, verse 33, which actually saves Paul's life. The commander came up, took hold of him, ordered him to be bound with two chains, and began to ask who he was and what he had done. The crowd, some were shouting one thing, some were shouting another. He couldn't find out the facts on account of the uproar, and he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. So they're going to take him back up the stairs into the barracks. And he got to the stairs, and it so happened that he was carried by the soldiers, kind of a mosh pit kind of a scene, right? Carried by the soldiers on their shoulders because of the violence of the mob. For the multitude of the people kept shouting and crying out, away with him. Away with him. Does that ring any bells? History repeats itself. Jesus came there with the message, it's not about the temple, it's about me. Paul has been bringing that message to the Gentiles. He comes back after all these years, and Israel votes again against the gospel. Away with him. And make no mistake, Luke wrote this on purpose. He wrote the gospel of Luke. He knows what away with them means in the life of Jesus, or away with him. He knows what that means. This is very important. That one little line is an indicator that Luke wants us to see a parallel here. The gospel has come back now through the Apostle Paul. Not some outcast Galilean fisherman, but a Jewish theologian who's gotten converted and has come back and said Jesus is the Messiah, or he's going to. Away with him. See? Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, verse 37. And he said to the commander, can I say something to you? This is a shock, because the commander doesn't know that Paul even knows Greek. And here he is fluent in Greek. And the commander's thinking this is just another terrorist. Paul says, hey, I need to talk to you. Now below him, as they're coming, they're about halfway up the steps here. And the people, the thing is just a complete uproar. It's a complete mess. Everybody's screaming. They want Paul killed. The Romans have just barely saved him. The guys, Romans have their swords out down there. And they're just going to kill somebody if they get any closer. It's just very, very tense. And Paul stops and he says to the commander, can I say something to you? The commander goes, you speak Greek? Then you're not the Egyptian terrorist that we thought you were. He thought he was this Egyptian guy who was a terrorist. Verse 39. Paul said, no, I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city. Cilicia, Tarsus was a very important town. He says, I'm a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people. This Roman, he has no idea what's going on here. He said, this guy's articulate. He sounds educated. What's he doing? Why are they trying to kill him? He looks just like a Jewish guy. He obviously knows what he's doing here. What in the world is going on? So in the confusion, he says, go ahead, talk to him. When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand. He's bleeding. He's bruised. He is in terrible shape. He stands here and he says, I can't pass up the opportunity to talk to these people. Now that's a committed preacher. Seriously. He motions to the people with his hand, and then there was a great hush, and then he spoke to them in Hebrew, which is actually Aramaic in this case. And the Roman guy's listening, and here he is speaking to the people in Hebrew, and he stretches out his hand. And now you got this scene where everybody's freaked out, and the dust is flying, and everybody's upset, and Paul just goes, hey, like this. The Romans are down the steps with the swords, just ready to kill a Jewish guy. And so here's Paul, and he wants to talk to the group. He can see everybody there, and everybody stops to listen. We're going to stop there. Sorry about that. It's just too much to handle in one morning. You got to come back next week. Or you can read ahead. You know, heaven forbid we should do that, but that's kind of radical. What a scene. What a scene. So let's ask some questions. You know, a lot of times you can learn a lot by asking questions. And the more you know about this, the more you know about what he did in coming to Jerusalem and taking this vow. Now, some of you should already be asking yourself, what in the world was he doing? If you know his message and you know what's going on in the gospel and you know the difference between Judaism and Christianity and you've been following with us, even the last 2 or 3 years here on Sunday mornings, the life of Christ and then the book of Acts, you would be well within your rights to be saying to yourself, what in the world is Paul doing going back there? And many scholars have criticized him for doing this. There are whole books and sections of commentaries written on the fact that several heavy hitters think that Paul made a huge mistake, like I talked about last week. So let me ask a couple questions. Number one, did James and Paul do the right thing? Or was this a mistake? Did James and Paul do the right... Now, it was the both of them. James and the guys apparently had come up with this plan before Paul got there because they had it right fresh in their notebook when he walked in. So they thought about this. They had thought about how they were going to promote unity between the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians, and they said the best thing to do is to let Paul show that he's not anti-Jewish. So we'll talk him into doing this vow. And the guys had started their Nazarite vow in enough time so that they could finish it with Paul. So this was planned. This is James and Paul. James, the half-brother of Jesus, and Paul, the apostle, had cooked this up to do this thing. Now, let me ask you this. Was it the right thing to do? Or was it a mistake? Well, it depends on what you mean by mistake. How do you evaluate what is a mistake and what is not a mistake? How do you evaluate when something is the right thing to do? Most people who criticize Paul here would say, well, he's being a hypocrite. But I completely disagree. I mean, you already know where I'm coming from because I mentioned it last week. I don't think he made a mistake in doing this. I think he knew he was going to get into trouble. And I don't think it's hypocrisy when a Jewish man in that era goes back and does the Jewish thing. That wasn't hypocrisy. In fact, it was exactly what he had preached all the way along. Jot down 1 Corinthians 9. I'm serious. Jot this down and look it up. It's very important to understand. 1 Corinthians 9, 19 to 23. 1 Corinthians 9, 19 to 23. Now, Paul had written Corinthians while he was in Ephesus on this journey he just finished. Okay? Within the last couple, 3 years, he had written 1 Corinthians. And in chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians, he says, I have become all things to all men. That's where he makes that famous statement. I've become all things to all men. He says, when I'm with the Jews, I'll act Jewish so that I might win the Jews. But see, now he's not a Greek acting Jewish. He's a Jewish man who could be really Jewish. So he says, I can actually do both of these. I can be in the Jewish community and I can be in the Greek community. And when I'm in the Jewish community, I will do the Jewish thing because it's the right thing to do. If I can bring them to Christ, that's what I'll do. He says it very clearly. And he says, when I'm in the Greek community and I'm up in the mountains above Achaia and they offer me pork rinds, it'll come to you. And I eat them. It's not because I just go up there to sneak a few pork rinds because I've always liked them. It's because it's what I do for the gospel because that's all they've got there. It's what they're offering me. I've got to bring the gospel to these people. I'm not going to stand on foolish consistency, the hobgoblin of little minds. It's not about food. And he makes that very clear in 1 Corinthians 9. If I had time, we would actually go there and do that passage, but we don't have the time this morning. But look it up when you get a chance. What he's doing is he's obeying a much deeper, more powerful law. He has a much more profound understanding of the gospel than food laws and nitpicking Pharisaical rules. And boy, everybody in that culture knew those rules. The Jewish culture knew those rules. Nobody knew them better than Paul. And he says, you want me to do the rules? No problem. And he says in 1 Corinthians 9, I know the law and I'm not under it, but I am very willing to go ahead and live there in Jerusalem with all the rules. That doesn't bother me a bit. Did it my whole life. The difference is, I know it has nothing to do with my salvation. Was it a mistake? Was it hypocrisy? I don't think so. For him to come back here and do this thing, I don't think it was hypocrisy. I think it was courageous. I think he went back because he wanted a chance to preach. Like I said a couple weeks ago, you read Romans again, Romans chapter 9, the first few verses, he said, I would trade my salvation if it would give salvation to these people. So was it a mistake? Well, if you think that in order for life to be successful, it has to always be easy, if your way of appraising whether something is a mistake is whether or not it's difficult, then of course it's a mistake. But on the other hand, if it's about pleasing the Lord, if your idea of success is something like people seem to assume when they criticize Paul here, well, it couldn't possibly be of God's will that something this violent should happen in the temple precincts. Really? It couldn't possibly be that the representative of the gospel should cause such a ruckus in Israel. That couldn't possibly be God's will. Really? That's exactly what happened with Jesus, and I'm sure that's what Luke is bringing out in the next few chapters. Well, it couldn't possibly be that God intended to lead me into a situation where I would be facing difficulties in order to represent Him. Really? How do you evaluate mistakes? What's a mistake and what's not a mistake? Here's another question. Did it work or did it backfire? Did it work? And here again, this is very similar. It's just a slight different look at it. Did it work or did it backfire? A lot of people look at this and they say, well, the whole thing backfired, obviously. I mean, if it had worked, there would have been low lights, soft music, the buses will wait, there'd be counselors at the wall, you know, the Romans would have gotten saved, would have been great. You know, that would have been working. That would have been the way it turned out. Nobody got saved. Paul almost got killed. The Romans don't understand a thing. The rest of the Christians took off back home. Did it work or did it backfire? It depends on what you mean by work. Before, you have to determine what you think a mistake is. Now you have to ask yourself, what is real work? What was the real work? Well, there were two things. And again, if we had more time, we could actually dig into these some more. But there were two things that needed to happen. Number one was that he needed to show solidarity with the Jewish Christians. He did do that. And the connection was made. By the way, when Jerusalem was destroyed, almost all the Christians escaped. You know why? They took Jesus' Olivet Discourse seriously. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, get out. And they did. And they escaped with their lives. Most of the Christians escaped. And from this moment, and you guys, this is very important. I know it doesn't seem like it maybe right this minute, but trust me. It's very important that he did this, because when he did this, and there was a connection between James and Paul right here, that meant the gospel was the gospel, and it wasn't just an extension of Judaism. And after the destruction of Jerusalem, the Jewish community made that very clear. If you're a Christian, you can't be a part of the rabbinic Judaism. And temple Judaism ended in 70 AD. There's no biblical temple Judaism today. It's all rabbinic Judaism. So it's very important. Did he achieve unity between the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians? He didn't make them all like each other. They didn't all snack together, right? They didn't all, you know... But he made a very clear statement, and James affirmed it. By the way, James was martyred within 3 years of this. He was killed by the next high priest in between the Roman procurators. In 62, James was killed. Paul made a real strong statement. Did it work? Yeah, it did work. What was the other thing he was supposed to do? Turn to chapter 23, verse 11. Looking ahead, you get a little indicator. Again, you got to ask yourself, what works and what doesn't? On the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, "Take courage," 23:11. "For as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause in Jerusalem, so you must witness in Rome also." Aha. So one of the purposes was to bear witness of the gospel in the presence of the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem. Did that happen? Yes. When you say, did it work or did it backfire? You got to be sure that you're saying, did the right thing work? Sometimes we look at the exterior of things and we say, well, it looks terribly disorganized. It looks like a riot. I'll bet it's a bad thing. And a lot of times behind the scenes, it's a very good thing. Because God is doing something behind the scenes, almost always, in everything. Let me close with just a couple of pieces of advice. First, there is a time when you must live according to Christian thinking, no matter how it turns out. You know, we make decisions a lot of time based on outcome-based decisions. I'm going to make a decision, and if it turns out the way I think it was going to, then therefore, that's a good decision. And there's a time to do that, by the way. When you invest finances, you expect to make a profit. If you don't make a profit, that was a bad investment. Period. End of conversation. No big mystery. And you say, well, I'll never do that again. But there's a lot of moral issues in life when it's actually okay to take a risk and know that you did the right thing no matter what. And there's a time when, as a believer in Jesus Christ, you simply have to think like a Christian no matter how the thing turns out. And the glory of it is that the success is in doing the right thing, not in how the thing turned out. The success is in doing the right thing. You guys, we are not raised that way. We are Americans. The success is in the outcome. Is it profit-making? Is it healthy? Is it happy? Is it fun? Is it successful? That's what we... And there are times when, as a Christian, that is just backwards. Jesus says, no. If that were true, I wouldn't have been crucified. And Paul lives right through this thing, living out that truth of Jesus. There are times when we as Christians have to say, I'm going to do the right thing no matter how it turns out. Because in this case, the right thing is simply doing it, not achieving it. It's simply the right thing. If I die, if the thing goes haywire, if it blows up in my face, I'm sorry, but I got to do this. This is the right thing to do. I tell you, it's a tough way to live. It's a gutsy way to live. And you may be challenged right now to be doing something just like that as a Christian. And I encourage you, do it. Now, in this case, this first piece of advice, this is when you really know the truth. You really know what to do. But you know it's going to be a pain. But you do it anyway. There's a time for that. Second piece of advice is when you don't know quite what to do. Here's that second piece of advice. There are also times when you must simply do your best under the circumstances and leave the results in God's hands. Slightly different. But there are times when you don't know exactly what to do and you got to take your best shot at it. You got to say, I don't know how this is going to turn out. I've tried to look into my crystal ball, and if I could figure out how it would turn out, I'd make the right decision every time. But the Lord hasn't revealed how it's going to turn out. So I have to, based on the wisdom God has given me right this moment, do the thing I think Jesus would do, or something like that. I got to think like a Christian, but I'm not sure how it's going to be. And I'm going to watch it. And you know something? When you do that, and then it fails on the outside, that is the issue I'm going to put my finger on right now. When you do the best you can under the circumstances to honor the Lord, and it goes haywire, and it blows up in your face, has that ever happened? If it has not happened to you, you need to get into the ministry. This is the truth. You know, one of the great educators is when you get into the ministry and you find out a lot of stuff you do, you just have to pray that God will use your mistake. Because you give it the best shot, you know, you say or do what you think is the right thing, and then what looks like a bad thing takes place. And you go back and you say, Lord, how can that be? Well, if anybody had a right to think that way, it was Paul right here. So take heart. There are times as a Christian when it really is okay to give it your best shot. Trust God with the circumstances. And believe that He's going to work behind the scenes even if it blows up in your face. It's like that saying from that engineer back in the 50s that has become one of my favorite ministry sayings. He wasn't a minister, but I love it. If a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing badly. I love that. Because we always think if a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing right, which is true as well. But if it's really worth doing, then you had better do it, even if you think you can't do it well. Did you catch that? I want you to catch that. If a thing is worth doing, you still have... I mean, I'm talking spiritually, from the Lord. If this is what you're called to, then you got to do it, even if you think you can't do it well. And you got to trust that God will do something good with it. And that means you got to trust Him with failure. Because if you do it and it fails, and you fail, can you handle the idea that God can use that? You want to talk humility? You want to talk trust in God? You guys, this is heavy stuff. This is heavy stuff. If you're tracking at this point in this, and you're looking at decisions you're making right now in your life, then the Lord's probably saying something like, are you going to trust me with this and give it your best shot? And let me handle your reputation. Let me handle the details. Let me handle what's going to happen in your life. Are you going to represent me here? Wow. Let's bow our heads. Take a moment to be sure that you really want to trust God. Tell Him, Lord, I really do. Here's what it is. And you know it. I don't need to know it. But hand it over to Him. Give Him the opportunity to say, yeah, I will be glorified in this. You have to do what you know is right, or you have to take your best shot at it. And I will use you in this. And you will live. Father God, we are really nervous about a lot of things in our lives. I am, and I'm sure most of the folks listening to me are, nervous about things that lie ahead in our lives, decisions we have to make, fear of taking responsibility for decisions, wondering how things are going to turn out. And so, Lord, we lay before you all these things, not because we are so certain that we're going to make profit or be healthy or be successful, but because we are certain that there are times when it's right to do the right thing. Help us to know those times. Give us insight and wisdom about it, Lord. We trust you to do it. And I lift up my brothers and sisters wrestling with issues right now like this. And I pray that your Spirit would guide them. We commit ourselves to you, Father, to your honor and to your glory and to the name of Jesus Christ, to the progress of the gospel and the deepening of Christians. We commit ourselves. And we ask simply that you would use us. And all God's people said, Amen.